From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. It's the moment of truth. Tomorrow, in downtown LA, a panel of judges, including yours truly, will determine the winner of KCRW and Gustavo's Great Tortilla Tournament. Here with a preview of the events is our tournament's namesake, Gustavo Arellano.
Hola, Evan.
After 4 weeks of eating 64 tortillas, 32 corn, 32 flour, into four brackets, we have finally reached the finals.
The finals of Gustavo's and KCRW's Great Tortilla Tournament. This is the second year. We're going to crown the winner on September 8th. Where are we doing this?
At La Plaza, near Olvera Street, near Union Station. So La Plaza de Artes y Culturas, awesome museum, big outdoor place. So we're going to have our finalists there. Free tortilla samples. We're going to have vendors. We're going to have Joe Bravo making his awesome tortilla art. So RSVP, go to kcrw.com/tortilla. But these are the finalists that are going to be there.
So I understand that this year we don't have a Fuerte Four. In fact, we have a Fuerte Five.
Scandal. Fuerte Five. We actually have a tie. We'll get to what the tie is in a bit. But yeah.
I don't even understand that, a tie.
Things happen. I always go back to sports. One time in Major League Baseball, there was an all-star game. And after 12 innings, basically, they couldn't play anymore because all the pitchers were used. And so the commissioner said, you know what? I'm declaring a tie. Was it popular? No. So here I declared a tie. Is it going to be popular? Oh, yeah. Because it just means more tortillas. Instead of four finalists you get to get samples from, you're going to get five. And whoever said no to more tortillas?
Nobody. Not me. That's for sure. So let's start with the corn bracket. We have number one seed, Taco Maria, going up against
number one seed from the other one, Kernel of Truth. So this is actually a rematch of last year between Kernel of Truth and Taco Maria. It just shows, number one, we're smart. Both you and Nick are smart, and you know what the best corn tortillas are in Southern California. But also, it's really, it's a testament to the quality of both Taco Maria and Kernel of Truth. Even though they're similar tortillas, they're making them completely different ways. And it just shows, again, how the corn tortillas are here in Southern California, that they were able to beat all comers. It's hard being number one, and they made it happen.
Yes, they did. And it's a testament to ingredients and care. Okay, so flour must be where we're having the tie.
So there's actually, first of all, flour is going to be controversial because there was a huge upset. Sonora Town, which was the champion last year, Golden Tortilla, still the buzz of Southern California for its amazing flour tortillas, lost. So the people they lost to is home state, which in some ways people are going to say, oh, no way, you know, Sonora Town's the best flour tortilla. And it's an amazing flour tortilla, and they still are at the same quality of last year. But I got to say, even though home state was not in my bracket, I saw that they upped their game.
But you know what I love about this? For me, it's just an opportunity to shine the light on a business that some people might say, well, that's just a hipster tortilla. But no, no, it is an actual Tex-Mex tortilla that has a whole story behind it, so much love, and is absolutely delicious.
Oh my God. And I remember them from last year. And last year they made it into the SO8. So it's not like they came out of nowhere. But these flour tortillas come from Texas. There's a history of braseros behind them. I mean, again, it's easy to say, oh, home state's some hipster place because, you know, a lot of hipsters go there. But hey, you know what? Sometimes hipsters know their stuff.
A woman-owned business, Brianna Valdez, totally inspired by her grandmother, Lala. And she was determined. She had been in LA for like 12 years. She was longing for her Tex-Mex tortilla, and she just doubled down, and she did it in her own home kitchen until she managed to recreate what her grandmother had made for the family.
And as someone who goes to Texas a lot, I could tell you this is a wonderful Tex-Mex style tortilla. I mean, she could go down to San Antonio and really make a run for it. And if you know your real Texas, Austin is not the capital of Tex-Mex. It's all San Antonio.
Okay, so home state is up against Burritos La Palma.
Yes.
An unbelievable flour tortilla. And La Monarca.
So this is all my fault. Burrito La Palma was a finalist last year. La Monarca actually faced off against Sonora Town last year in my bracket, and it happened again. So I ate, I think, geez, I tried 12 different rounds between Burrito La Palma and La Monarca. I ate them by themselves. I put some salt on them. I put butter on them, even though I'm not a butter person, as the video show. put some salsa. I even ripped sometimes to see.
Oh my gosh.
Not just rolled, but ripped. I made quesadillas, I made burritos, and I just could not see or taste which one was better because they're both that excellent. La Monarca, I loved them from last year. Same thing happened. Burrito La Palma, again, is my favorite. And so what I figured, you know what? For the final, for the flour bracket, let's just make it Burrito La Palma versus La Monarca versus Home State.
So when do we get to find out the number one corn and the number one flour?
So now if we have our Fuerte Five, so on September 8th, that's when we're going to do our tasting. The first round is going to be corn, so Kernel of Truth versus Taco Maria. In front of everyone on a stage, we're going to eat, and then we're going to declare our winner. In the flour round, Burrito La Palma versus La Monarca versus Home State, same thing. We're going to eat it there. One-on-one-on-one, you only see that like in WWE matches, like Hulk Hogan.
And it really does feel kind of scary because everybody's standing there staring at us. And we're like, oh my goodness, we're making this decision that, you know.
I love this. Like, we're the learned elders of tortillas in front of everyone, then going to the side and say, wait, mere mortals, we will soon declare which is the fairest tortilla in the land. And of course, we're going to have a people's champion as well. I'm sure we'll figure out some way, because we're going to have those five finalists right there giving out samples. So tell us, who do you think is the best ones, or if we're wrong or if we're right?
Yeah, so we do it in two rounds. So if you're earlier at the event, you'll get to hear who the two finalists are, corn and flour. And then later on in the event, we crown the ultimate winner.
The golden tortilla, the winner of corn versus flour, is going to get the golden tortilla. And look, there's some people who say, well, why does there have to be a winner? Can't just flour and corn rule? And I say, no.
Yes, I was that person I was that hippie person that you were making fun of.
I'm sorry, but eventually, I mean, could there be a tie at the end? Hey, one never knows, but hopefully someone will emerge on top. And that said, these are the best tortillas right now in Southern California. So everyone should go out, not just RSVP for our finale for the tortilla tournament, but afterwards, patronize these places. And more importantly, especially once you get into the round of 16, the Suave 16, all of those are excellent tortillas. And the whole purpose of this competition wasn't just to crown a winner, but to encourage all of you, especially good food listeners, KCRW, eat great tortillas. Eat better tortillas.
And travel around and taste tortillas from places where you've never been before.
Learn your Southern California. Don't just stick to mission. No mission, please.
No mission. Okay. Once again, the second annual tortilla tournament happening on September 8th at Plaza de Artes y Cultura across from Olvera Street. Please go to kcrw.com/tortilla and RSVP just so we can make sure we have enough food.
From 3 p.m. to 7 p.m., family-friendly, free, with free tortilla samples as well, Tortilla Arts. It's a great time, and let's really make this annual tradition.
Thank you so much, Gustavo.
Gracias.
I've been talking to Gustavo Arellano about the Great Tortilla Tournament. Join us from 3 to 7 p.m. tomorrow at La Plaza downtown to find out which of the Fuerte Five gets to take home the golden tortilla. There will be tacos, tortilla samples, music, and more. RSVP and details at kcrw.com/tortilla. After the break, we're taking a closer look at one of the Fuerte Five, a visit to home state when we return.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleinman. Now for a more personal look at one of the tortilla makers in the flour category. This week, the restaurant Home State won a stunning upset over Sonora Town, the winner of last year's contest. I visited owner Brianna Valdez at her Hollywood location to learn more about her Texas roots, as well as what inspired her to bring Tex-Mex-style flour tortillas to L.A. I'm here in the eastern part of Hollywood on Hollywood Boulevard at Home State with Brianna Valdez. Home State opened in 2013. It was the first time that a certain kind of Tex-Mex came to LA. Brianna decided to teach us all how to eat queso and wrap our tacos in flour tortillas. Hi, Brianna.
Hi, Evan.
So congratulations on still being here and expanding monumentally over the past year.
Thank you so much. It's so nice to have you here.
So you were the first to make us all aware here in Southern California that you could actually have a taco with the filling nestled into a flour tortilla instead of a corn tortilla.
What an honor. It was my dream to be, well, it was my dream to have them in LA because I moved here in 2000 and I just started looking for food from home, from Texas, and I couldn't find a taco in a flour tortilla. And I thought, why is this a foreign object? I didn't know it was so special to the region until I left.
So once you made the decision to open Home State and use the flour tortilla kind of like a calling card, the central piece to everything else you were doing, how did you go about figuring out how to make it?
That's such a good question. Thank you for asking, because it was so important for me to get that right before I did anything else. I mean, I was writing business plans and making up financials to start this idea, but I knew that the most important thing I could do was spend my time really refining and understanding and teaching myself how to make the flour tortilla. So for me, it was absolutely the foundation and the vessel for the mission. It was my airplane.
So did you fly back home to Texas and take lessons?
I didn't. I was in my kitchen in my tiny duplex in Larchmont Village, and I put a picture of Grandma Lala. Her name was Librada, but we didn't find that out until her funeral. So Grandma Lala, I put a picture of her in my kitchen, and I blasted the Hano music, and I pulled a bunch of recipes from my mom and my grandma's recipes close as I could. I switched it from lard, which she used, manteca. I substituted butter. I was vegetarian for so long, and I knew that was something I wanted to be more universally approachable and accessible for vegetarians. So I just started making the dough and getting the feel for it and rolling tortillas, which I was god-awful at, all kinds of shapes, not round. And I channeled her spirit, and I put love into them.
Food is so powerful. Now you're making me cry. Did you end up using any kind of special flour blend, or you just went to the store, bought a bag of all-purpose flour?
Yeah, I went to Trader Joe's and got the flour, and then I started with King Arthur, and then I played around with a few different flours, and at the end of the day, ended up, you know, now today we just use an all-purpose flour, and it's something that I've always wanted to spend time exploring the different potentials for flour, but it's something we haven't done yet, but oh, maybe we will in the future, but for now, it's how we do it.
So what defines a Tex-Mex flour tortilla?
Well, I will say that the Tex-Mex flour tortilla is the only flour tortilla I know. So what defines it for me is the size. It's not too big and it's not too small. And it's dusted in flour. So for me, that's something I love, touching the flour tortilla and having a little dust on my hands. And the pillow, it's very pillowy. It's not too thin. It's not too thick. For me, I like a texture that has body and holds up. It's not so overwhelming that it's all that you taste. So the pillowy flour tortilla dusted in flour is the Texas flour tortilla that I wanted to share. And hopefully that's what we're giving you when you order your tacos.
I mean, that really is a perfect description, because when I think of your tortillas, I think of that powderiness.
Great.
Which is really a defining characteristic of them. I also think of how interesting it is that they're simultaneously delicate yet strong, because, I mean, I've told other people this story before, but there was this period of time where I couldn't use my kitchen at all. And you might remember it. And I came here and I think I ordered like 20 tacos. And that's what I lived on for like a week. And they held up so beautifully. It was amazing. But tell me who's making them now.
We make our tortillas in-house. So the people that are making the tortillas are the people that you see in the stores. We make our dough on site. We make our balls on site. We press. So everything is done in the restaurants. We don't do anything outside.
Are the balls made by hand by the maker, and then is it rolled out, or do you use any kind of press just to make it faster?
Great question. So yes, the balls are made by hand. We weigh every ball to make sure it's consistent, and then they are pressed. We use a press from San Antonio. It was really important to me when we had to stop hand rolling, because we used to hand roll every single tortilla, but we would run out every single day. So now we're making at Hollywood location almost 2,000 tortillas a day. So we did have to move to a press a few years ago. It was a major moment for me to surrender to that because I thought it would make it less family. Like, I always want you to feel like you're eating in our home at Home State. So I wanted it to feel like your grandma was cooking for you. And I thought that would change, but it didn't change. It just allowed us to provide flour tortillas for everyone every day, and it made a more consistent product. And, you know, when our press is down, which it's down today, we do go back to hand rolling. I just want to send out a alert to everyone because there is something so special about the hand roll that you really do taste a difference. So hopefully you'll have one today.
Is there a dedicated tortilla person, or does everyone in the kitchen know how to make it?
There is a dedicated person. The idea in the beginning was to have everyone understand the tortilla, how to make it, the feel that it should be. But there is a familiarity and a deepening of understanding when you have that consistent relationship with the dough and how it feels, so that we wanted somebody to have that deep relationship so they could really protect the quality and know when something's wrong, and even subtle differences in the weather, as you know, I mean, make a big change. So being able to keep that quality control and oversight is important for me, that somebody owns that and has that level of pride, knowing that all the tacos that are going out are made with the dough that she made, and the balls that she rolled, and the tortilla that she pressed. And there's a certain level of pride that you get when you see something through from the beginning to the end. We have a few people in the company that have been with us almost since the very beginning, Reina, Paola, and Patty. They are the tortilla queens. They know that dough. It's like a second skin for them. So having them on our team is so important for me, and we honor them, and they keep the whole machine rolling,
so to speak. So when you opened your other locations in Highland Park and now in Playa,
right,
did you take one of the queens and relocate them and have apprentices learning until they could go back to where they were before? Or did you just move them to a different location?
We were lucky enough to have, in our Highland Park location, Paola, who was here for years, did relocate to Highland Park. And she lived closer to there, so it was convenient for her. But, you know, I jumped at the chance to have somebody who had such familiarity with our tortilla program. And at Playa Vista is the first time that we had somebody new, but she trained here at Hollywood, which is our, you know, where it all started, and the soul is so strong, and spirit of the tortilla is here. So we had her apprentice here and then go to Playa Vista, and she's just owning that tortilla program over there and doing a great job. You know, the flour tortilla represents for me my family's story, because when we were children, Grandma Lala was always in the kitchen. We visited a lot. She lived nearby, so we were able to visit her every weekend. And the sound of her rolling pin hitting the counter, and the smell of the tortillas cooking, and the image of her standing in the kitchen making meals for a very large family and their kids and their, you know, their kids, we have a big family. It, to me, symbolized a warmth and a love that I think when you leave home, you crave familiarity. And the flour tortilla for me really represented home. And something missing from my life, and I didn't realize what it represented until I really got into it. And I'm so proud to know that it resonated with people who weren't familiar with the flour tortilla, who didn't have any real love or respect for it, that now has a place in a culinary world like LA is something I'm so proud of. You know, we have a picture of Grandma Lala in each restaurant. When we opened Playa Vista, I put her picture right near the tortilla station because I really always want to have her presence in my mind and the restaurants infused with that kind of love and nourishment and care that she had for our family. I want the people that come to Home State to feel that same level of care. So it's representative of something really special to me, and it's the honor of my lifetime to be able to share that.
Let's go eat.
So we're now in the kitchen watching Reina, our tortilla maker, hand roll tortillas. Can you smell them? And she's hand rolling tortillas. ¿Qué estás haciendo?
Estoy haciendo tortillas de harina. Tortilla de harina. She
said she makes them very carefully, makes sure the dough is perfect, and she makes them with love. God, they're, look at these tortillas.
It's like being in a happy place. So is that queso hat your hat?
It is. It's actually my license plate.
So it's a baseball hat, and it is the old-fashioned California plate where it's a black background and the almost neon yellow writing, and it says California, and then queso.
If you ever see that license plate driving around town, just give me a wave.
That was Brianna Valdez, owner of Homestate. Tomorrow, you can see her in person at the La Plaza de Culturas y Artes as she faces off with three other tortilla makers for the Golden Tortilla. Visit kcrw.com/tortilla to RSVP and for more info. After the break, we're visiting with a couple of coffee entrepreneurs who are marrying beans with zines. Find out more when Good Food returns. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman.
You know, we sort of think about what this idealized coffee bar experience is, that one of the great things about a really good coffee shop is that you're going to interact with people, meet people from totally different walks of life who are doing interesting things, that it's kind of this place where freelancers and creatives hang out, and maybe we can kind of capture that experience.
That's self-described coffee weirdo Tony Kinesny. When I last spoke with him a few years ago, he was spearheading a subscription coffee roasting service called Tonks Coffee. Now he's back with a new venture with his partner Sumi Ali. Together, they are Yes Please, a weekly delivery service marrying great coffee and magazine writing. How did each of you get into coffee? Sumi, let's start with you.
Well, I feel like I kind of grew up in coffee. My parents were Dunkin' Donuts franchisees.
Wow.
Yeah, so I grew up like behind the counter of their shop. So when it was time for me to finally like get a job, I felt really comfortable just jumping behind the bar of a coffee shop. So there's just this little independent coffee shop in the back of the library in our little town outside of Chicago. I fell right into it.
First of all, I love that there was a coffee shop in the back of the library. And I'm just curious to know, when did you realize that the coffee that you had grown up with at Dunkin' Donuts may not have been the ideal cup?
My first day at my first real job, I remember going in and asking the manager to make me a vanilla latte because that was my drink. You know, I was a kid and it was delicious. And immediately I found myself like trying to articulate why this vanilla latte was different. It was less sweet, but more flavorful. And like delicate and nice. And I just knew from then that like this is different than what I thought it was.
And what about you, Tony?
Well, I'd lived in New York for 10 years and worked a series of corporate jobs. And around the time of 9/11, I ended up in Seattle, where a lot of friends had sort of fled to when the dot-com bubble burst. And I thought, okay, I'm done with the rat race for a while. I'll just sort of cool my heels by getting a job in a coffee shop, which I had no qualifications for. But I quickly fell in love with Espresso Vivace, which was the most interesting sort of coffee experience that you could get in Seattle at that time. And their biggest account was a shop on Capitol Hill called Victrola. And I walked in, I gave them a 7-page resume where I interviewed myself for the job and talked about how completely unqualified I was to work in coffee or the service industry. They hired me the next day, and about a year later, they bought a roaster and asked if I would take on figuring out how to roast coffee, and I just kind of fell in love with it quickly.
The universe of coffee, we now understand, is quite akin to that of wine. When did just a simple cup of coffee become this intimidating, unapproachable, at times super elitist, and make you feel ashamed for your own taste? When did that happen?
Well, I think there was this movement that happened with independent coffee shops in the early 2000s that was kind of a reaction to Starbucks, that Starbucks really created the market for this category of beverages, lattes, cappuccinos, and sort of specialty coffee beverages. And in an effort to kind of distinguish themselves, I think that emerging sort of third wave of coffee was chasing this culinary credibility. And so we wanted to elevate it. We wanted to kind of make it more precious, more unobtainable, to sort of frame it in the same terms as wine.
It's such a strange business because on one hand, it's the thing that everybody reaches for when they're just bleary-eyed in the morning. So on one level, it's almost like medicine, right?
Right.
Or a drug, we could say. And that thing that you reach for in the morning may be very different than that thing that you have after a meal or in the mid-afternoon. And yet, the business itself has become so much more sophisticated. So many roasters, so many coffee shops that incorporate roasting. How does a coffee company sort of balance out those two needs of people?
Well, I think there's a degree to which, like, those of us who work in the industry, you know, for us, it's this cornucopia. We're tasting all these different flavors. We're learning all these sort of sensory skills to discern all these amazing things about coffee, the different plant varieties, the different processing techniques, so much that can happen in the roast. And so it's this rabbit hole. And for us, it's a passion. It's a hobby. But I think that we haven't really figured out how to translate that to the consumer, that there's kind of an ontology around quality that we have internally that's very much based on understanding the supply chain and kind of the nuts and bolts of how the sausage gets made and what sort of ends up in the cup. You know, we're kind of asking people to swim upstream to figure out what their personal preferences are and sort of expect them to be able to identify all of these nuanced flavors, to approach it almost like wine tasting, where it is really intimidating that if you pick up a bag of coffee and it says that you're going to taste apricot and jasmine and marmalade or something, and you don't experience that in the cup, it's kind of saying that, well, maybe this isn't for you. Maybe you're not sophisticated enough. Maybe you just don't love coffee as much as these people who seem really enthusiastic about it. And I think that that's kind of a mistake, that we've sort of lost sight of the gestalt of coffee, that it's not so much a question of that you need to find your personal preference, it's that you need to sort of have the basic confidence to say whether you like or dislike something and not feel like that there's a wrong answer for that.
And that's really hard. I mean, even for myself, who's in this rarefied world, I find it really hard sometimes to say, you know, I really don't want coffee that is like lemonade. It's not my thing.
And I think we agree with you. I mean, I don't want to drink that every day. And in this pursuit to achieve culinary validation, we've left a lot of people behind, you know? And I think as an industry, and we've been guilty to play a part in this, but we haven't built any on-ramps for people to be enthusiasts.
So what you're doing now is really interesting. It's blends. I received a package. I think it was the week of July 8th, and I grabbed the bag actually just today for the first time because I ran out of my previous coffee. And so I grabbed the bag to grind, and I was looking for the variety, and I see there's three varieties on the bag. And I thought to myself, oh, that's interesting. And it was a different coffee experience for a curated coffee experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the conceits that we have going into this is that when I first started roasting, it was all about blends. That in the early days of kind of this third wave movement, it was very much espresso focused, sort of filter coffee, drip coffee was considered kind of a second fiddle. As we started to kind of explore single origin coffees in more depth and really think about the supply chain and the sourcing and the quality of the ingredients, it was all about how do we represent, you know, the beauty and the intrinsic character of these ingredients. And it's sort of like the, you know, the Alice Waters.
It's like the farmer's market and loving this particular peach grown by that farmer.
Yep. And now I think it's like it's time for the pendulum to kind of swing back and say that, you know, we can cook with these things, that the mentality of among a lot of our colleagues, and I think we've been guilty of speaking this kind of language ourselves, is that, you know, as a roaster, all we can do is sort of make the coffee worse, that it comes to us in this pristine, handed down by Mother Nature, that the farmer did all this work, and then it arrives here in the States, and now it's just kind of a vulgarity of roasting and barista craft and service that gets it to the customer, and that it loses something in that process. And I think with blending, it sort of opens up the door to say that, you know, there's more creativity, there's some authorship, that we think that 9 times out of 10, any single origin coffee, no matter how beautiful it is, if you just tweak it a little bit, add another coffee, another two coffees, there's always a way to make it better or more interesting, more crowd-pleasing, more dynamic, more balanced. Not always. And you know, we're not committed to only doing blends. We've released several single origins. We'll continue to do that.
So talk to me about the subscription service, because I remember with Tonks, that was, you know, breakthrough at the moment to... It wasn't like on Amazon now, where every product that one has every day, you have the option.
Subscribe and save.
Yeah, to subscribe and save. How does Yes Please, the delivery service, work?
We've tried to make it a little easier this time, that we ship weekly, but you can sign up for a weekly subscription, a fortnightly subscription, every third week, every month, whatever sort of fits your needs.
And do you curate the blends, or what's in the bag, is it a surprise, or do people make preferences known?
Well, every week we kind of approach each release as a fresh start. So we never release the same blend twice.
Along with the beans, each delivery is accompanied by the Yes Please Weekly, which is a thematic ad-free publication with stories that range from music to laundry. I love that it's a newspaper, because it kind of brings you back to that coffee and newspaper in the morning, and not everybody actually has a physical newspaper anymore. We're also used to digital delivery. How does the newspaper help you communicate with your subscribers?
Right. Well, I think there's a couple of angles on that. I mean, one is that, you know, we sort of think about what this idealized coffee bar experience is, that one of the great things about a really good coffee shop is that you're going to interact with people, meet people from totally different walks of life who are doing interesting things, that it's kind of this place where freelancers and creatives hang out. And maybe we can kind of capture that experience by saying, like, let's have a zine that's focused on, you know, some of the things that our customers are doing or our customers are interested in, or artists and creative people, or anyone that's doing something interesting that's sort of a story that maybe doesn't fit in another magazine. And then it's fun. It's something to read while you're drinking your coffee. It sort of brings that a little bit of a respite from the digital notifications all the time, that we think your home coffee routine should be this little window that you make your own coffee, you kind of own this time, you can have this analog experience, unplug for a few minutes. And so there's a bit of a nostalgia factor.
Yes, and actually in the weekly zine that I got, there was an editorial, perhaps, on how to listen to music.
Yeah.
That I really loved. It was about, you know, you don't have to have, you know, ADD while you're listening to music. You can just listen to music like some of us used to do back in the day. Take that moment. I really loved that. And then there was another article about aloneness, which I thought was so interesting. How are you sourcing writers?
We have a lot of contributors that reach out to us, but we have an editorial team that finds writers and photographers.
I mean, it's like choosing two businesses.
Yeah, I mean,
that aren't so easy.
We really try not to silo, but because of the kind of gauntlet that a weekly publication and a weekly release of beans is, there's like a little bit of like, you do this, I do this kind
of. Oh, of course.
But it's, I mean, the creative side of this in terms of like the roasting and the blending and the tasting coffee and the working on the magazine, like this is the fun part. It's hard work. We lose sleep over it, but it's not the part of, you know, paying the bills and making the trains run on time. The sort of business side of it is also unrelenting, but much less fun than this. So I think, you know, we've been fortunate that we know a lot of great writers and artists and photographers. So we've been able to start with like a really interesting crew of people and really interesting subject matter. And initially we were going to sort of have each zine have a separate theme. In early issues we did, our second issue was sort of about the classroom to prison pipeline, and sort of we talked to Scott Heschinger, who's a Brooklyn public defender who's doing a lot of work with the ACLU, and just kind of focusing a spotlight on things that we thought were interesting. And it just became kind of, as we went, every fourth issue is still a music issue. And I think that's going to continue to be the case for us. So we try to include a playlist with every issue, and we're getting some interesting people to curate playlists for us, including some KCRW DJs.
Well, there you go. I knew it was going to come full circle. Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed my coffee, and I really enjoyed the zine.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
I've been talking with Tony Kinesny and Sumi Ali, the men behind Yes Please. You can learn more about their coffee and magazine subscription at yesplz.coffee. Coming up, what is the natural wine craze all about? Alice Firing is here to explain it all. Stick around. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. There are many misconceptions about natural wine, that they don't age, are cloudy, or if we're getting super extreme, that they're brown and oxidized and taste like wet socks and curry. Alice Firing has been a longtime lover of natural wine, a label we're starting to notice more at our favorite local wine shops and restaurants. Natural wine is still wildly misunderstood, so Alice is here for a quick tutorial in appreciation and selection. Hi, Alice.
Hello, Evan.
By definition, what is a, quote, natural wine?
Alice's definition is nothing added, nothing taken away, except maybe adding a little bit, tiny bit of sulfites, and of course starting from organic viticulture.
Why is the descriptor used?
When I started writing about natural wine about 20 years ago, we didn't use natural wine. It was just wine. It was just wine without stuff in it. Or it was wine that always had been before this modern invention of making market-driven wines. But shortly, like somewhere around about 2008, the word probably got picked up because there were bar au vin naturel in France. But it's important to remember that natural, because it comes from the French, naturel, would really mean plain, unadorned, like chips naturel or yogurt naturel. And it really does come out of that.
So for us in America, where this word has a slightly different meaning, how do you distinguish between natural, biodynamic, and, quote, sustainable wine?
All of those, except for natural, go back to farming. So sustainable, to me, just means that the winemaker, the farmer, reserves the right to use chemical. And it really means absolutely nothing. It could mean that you use Roundup, you use a slew of chemicals, but maybe use a little bit less than your neighbor. Organic means that you follow the organic method of farming. And organic wine means different things in America and Europe. In America, you can add any additive as long as it's organic, but you're not allowed to use any added sulfites. In Europe, you can use any additive as long as it is deemed organic, but you can use up to 100 parts per million of sulfites. Biodynamic farming means that you follow the biodynamic farming protocol, which means you're using animal, mineral, or vegetable substances for your farming. So it's kind of uber organic. It's timed to the seasons. And as far as the wine is concerned, and it's Demeter who usually gives that certification, it is almost natural. You really are not allowed to use added yeast or added enzymes, and it's kind of held back a bit. Natural, there's no certification, so you basically have to do your work and study.
So remind us what role sulfates have in wine.
I like to think of them as kind of hairspray for a wine or hair gel. They are an antibacterial, but they're also, when they're used in high doses, it really focuses in the flavors and the textures, and it really makes sure that wine does not move. So it's not affected greatly by heat, by light, and it makes for a stable product.
There are more than 72 official additives that could be added to conventional wine. Could you give us some examples and explain to us why they're deemed necessary by the winemakers who use them?
Well, let's start with the second part of that question about why. With all of these additives, and a large part of those 72 are all the various kinds of enzymes that you can use in wine. But it's really important if you're making over a certain amount of case, like many large wineries make 500,000 cases or more, that that is product that is stable when it gets to the customer. And so that customer also wants something that's going to taste exactly the same year to year. So all those additives help that winemaker, that producer, that manufacturer to make sure there are no surprises in the bottle. That's great for some people. There are those of us who want a very different experience with wine. So some of those, I'll give you just, you know, the broad categories. Yeast, there's, and go back to baking bread. A lot of the breads that we're like, that we really do love these days are native yeast ferment, wild ferment. The same thing with wine. As you know, there are lots of different kinds of yeast that can control the flavor and the aroma and the texture of a bread. Same thing with wine. Then there are additives to keep the fermentation, basically feed your yeast nutrients. Some of those are urea, and some things are just very, you know, kind of tame, like yeast hulls. Then there are enzymes that help break down the skin. There's added acid if your wine needs a little lift. There are anti-foaming agents, and there are some chemicals that keep a certain yeast that is very unfashionable, called Brettanomyces, that taste a little bit sheepy or farm-like. And that anti-Brett is used to subdue that.
Okay, so let's talk about flavors. Do you think that natural wines taste different from their conventional counterparts? And if so, how?
Yes, very much so. In fact, I got here 20 years ago because of the taste. And then I found out that the philosophy aligned with mine. So basically, I want to drink the way I eat. So the way they taste, there will be surprises. They will provoke certain emotions. They might have a little bit more zingy acidity. There may be some little bit of bitterness in the best sort of way. They are not focused on the grape flavor, but actually transporting the vintage and the place into that bottle as best the winemaker can manage. Yes, there are a tremendous range of flavors and fragrance and textures that you can have in a natural wine. All Sauvignon Blanc won't taste like grassy grapefruit.
So also, when you gave us that little history lesson about natural wine used to just be wine, explain for those of us who may not have the historical context how wine became this other thing.
After World War II, we had all this lovely DDT and nitro-based explosives that needed a place to go, and we retrofitted them for agriculture. That was the beginning of the end of natural viticulture. And by the 70s, especially in France, that started to take hold. At the same time, because you're adding those kind of chemicals into the vineyard, all of a sudden the fruit was not tasting the same and it was bereft. It needed some help. So then came massive amounts of sulfur and yeast and sugar. That was probably the beginning. At the same time, all around the world, wine additives started to become a business. There was already yeast, but those started to get very, very sophisticated, and then the other controls started to come in. So we started to see really heavy-duty end to traditional wines and the coming of a market-driven wine by the end of the 80s into the 90s, and then to when all hell broke loose around 2000, when traditional wines really almost became extinct.
What's so interesting to me is that you're asking us, or natural wine advocates are asking drinkers to open their minds to a time when there may not be a human link to remember what those wines were like, because we're talking about people who are at the end of their life now. So that's kind of fascinating.
No, I'm really lucky that I started to drink in the 70s. And, you know, I was young and I was excited about it, like people are excited about wine whenever they get into it. But I had that base of knowledge of what wine used to taste like. So when it changed around 2000, I was like, hey, guys, what the hell's going on here? You know, I want my wine back. And that was what led me into the search for natural wine. And what's remarkable now, there's a whole generation clamoring for these wines, and they don't have any history with a more commercial wine, that they just cut their teeth on natural wine and they're running with it.
How do we shop for it? What's your importer back label trick?
Well, I started advising people to do this, you know, also about like 20 years ago. And now it's really no secret, but it still is the best way when you don't have me on your speed dial or another friend or sommelier. So basically, go to a wine shop or even in a restaurant, turn over the bottle of wine that comes to your table and see who the importer is. In the United States today, we have about, 30 importers that specifically import natural wine, which is huge. In 2000, there were two. So this is quite dramatic. And you're looking for the names that I give a little cheat sheet in the book, I think with a good number of those names, and you're really shortcut into saying, I don't know who this producer is, never heard of them, but if Jenny and Francois brought them in, okay, this is a good shot that it's going to be a natural wine.
So what natural wine should we drink before we die?
That was a tricky chapter to write. And whoever you're going to ask, you're going to get another one of on this list. To give context, some of these people that I put down don't exist anymore. Their label doesn't exist anymore. But they were really important to the natural wine movement and to those of us who started drinking before these wines became a fad. Some of these are very old world, like Emidio Pepe, wines that are revered in natural wine circles or conventional wine circles. Some of them are like also going back to Italy, Trinchero, that really isn't, you don't see around very much, but has never, ever made wine in a different way. Somebody that's going to be on everybody's list would be Pierre Auvernois, and he's from the Jura. And those wines have become, unfortunately, incredibly expensive because they're so sought after. And then there are others like Thierry Pouzelot that is not terribly expensive, but he was there at the beginning and is making beautiful wines. So I think that in the list that I have in the book, it takes you on the rare natural wine collector spectrum to those that you can find in your neighborhood shop.
Thank you so much, Alice. It's so wonderful, Natural Wine for the People. It's we should say it's almost like a graphic novel.
Thank you. I think that Nishant Shokshi, who did the illustrations, really, he was brilliant. It's an adorable book. I'm pretty happy to have my first illustrated book.
Yeah, it's marvelous. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's author and onophile Alice Firing. We've been discussing natural wine and her primer, Natural Wine for the People. Finally, here we are with the Market Report. Here's Jillian Ferguson.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. We're on the road again this week, reporting from the Mar Vista Farmers Market at Venice Boulevard and Grandview. And one of my favorite things about visiting other markets is getting to meet new farmers. Megan Strom is one of the owners of County Line Harvest. And Megan, I distinctly remember when I first saw your booth here in Mar Vista, I saw these gorgeous greens from halfway down the block and thought, I have to go shop there immediately. Tell us a little bit about the background of the farm and where you're growing.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much for being here. Welcome to Mar Vista. So we started the farm 19 years ago up in Petaluma on the Marin-Sonoma County line, hence our name County Line Harvest. And we started growing these baby greens because we're in the coastal hills and selling them to restaurants. And winters started getting rainier and rainier. And so we were opting for another way to have year-round production and year-round employment. So we leased land down in Thermal in Coachella Valley, and we're on 120 acres out there. Our production out there is mid-October through the end of June. And so over the winter, we do greens and baby root vegetables and bunching greens. And then in the summer, we switch production up to Petaluma, and that's where these greens are coming from right now.
Yeah, so let's talk about these lettuces. I'm looking at them right now. Your stand every week is so beautiful. What's the secret to getting such vibrant, beautiful greens?
Well, thank you. So it all starts with the seed. We are sourcing heirloom seeds. The majority of them are coming from Seed Savers Exchange out of Iowa, who is working really hard to preserve heirloom seeds. And we have hand-picked the varieties that go into our mix. So we have trialed them based on flavor, ultimately, but color and texture, and to make sure that they all grow at the same rate. Both our Petaluma farm and our thermal farm have warm days and cool nights. And then we go out at sunrise and we harvest lettuce only for the first few hours of the day. Once that sun peaks and it gets, you know, over 80 degrees, we're done with lettuce harvest. And I think that really helps maintain the sweetness in the leaf.
Tell us what varieties you're growing right now this time of year in September.
So we have beautiful Little Gem and Baby Red Romaine, which both have a really nice crunchy heart, and they actually both come to about a half a pound per head. So there's a lot of lettuce tucked inside of there. And then as far as the heirloom varieties that make up the mix, we have a Tango, Lola Rosa, Speckled Romaine. We do an heirloom iceberg in there. We do oaks, green, and a couple different reds, and then some really funky dark, dark reds and Rosimo, different varieties that we've just seen that have been nice to work together.
Something that you do that is surprisingly unique here at the farmers market is you sell your greens unwashed. What is the benefit of doing that?
Yeah, so it's not surprising up in the Bay Area. And so that was a new one for me when I came into the LA markets, is that I would have people walk into the booth, ask if they were washed, and then walk out when they found out that they weren't washed. And as first generation farmers on leased land, you know, we have limited infrastructure of what we can do to the produce post-harvest. And over time, I've come to realize that that's actually a benefit, because a lot of times in commercial wash lines, lettuces are being washed in chlorine water, and then they're being spun dry quite aggressively. And so the purpose of that is, of course, to get them dry, but extra moisture is being taken out of the leaf to preserve the shelf life. And so with that comes flavor and nutrients. You know, we've just found over time that if people take the extra time to wash it in their own kitchen, you know, our lettuces can last in the fridge up to 2 weeks. And I think that's a big part of why people are so surprised by the taste, is that it hasn't been altered in any way. So, you know, our arugula is spicy. Our mustards are as well, you know, and you get the full flavor profile.
And what can we expect from County Line as the seasons start to change and we get into fall?
So up in Petaluma, we're already starting to see some cooler nights, and we got our first chicory plantings in, which is very exciting. We were early this year. So we buy in heirloom chicory seed from Italy, and again, have handcrafted this mix of Rosa di Verona and Chioggia variegata, Puntarella, Pandezucchero, and those will be ready for a mid-October harvest, and then they'll last all the way through April. So really beautiful bitter green. That do have some sweetness to them as well.
Can't wait for that. Thank you so much, Megan.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That was Megan Strom, co-owner of County Line Harvest. You can find her lettuces and other produce at the Mar Vista Sunday Market and also on Saturdays at Santa Monica Pico and Torrance. One of the chefs who loves to shop with Megan here at County Line Harvest is Deborah Taylor. Deborah is the chef at Botanica in Silver Lake. She actually grew up just down the street from the Mar Vista Farmers Market on Inglewood Boulevard. And Deborah, you're here at the market today. What are you looking for at this stand?
Well, at Megan's stand, I love everything, but in particular, I love her lemon cucumbers. At the restaurant, we make a salad with heirloom melons, lemon cucumbers, pickled Fresnos, flowering watercress, and house-made almond ricotta with a mulatta vin. Super spicy and smoky and fresh. And with her cucumbers, it really ties it all together and brings out the seasons.
What is the vinaigrette that you just mentioned?
It's a mulata, which is a mix of Mexican chilies. We put almonds, pine nuts, Mexican oregano, olive oil, sesames. The peppers themselves are mulata. It's like a burnt mulata vinaigrette.
And what about that almond ricotta? Does that mean it's a vegan ricotta?
Yes, the dish is completely vegan, and I celebrate the almonds in three ways. So we take raw almonds and soak them, and then we put them in a dehydrator at 118 degrees, which keeps them alive and have their enzymes, and then we chop them up. And then we make an almond ricotta, which we soak almonds, and then put them in the blender with water and make like a cheese almond ricotta.
Tell us a little bit more about your relationship with County Line and how you got to know Megan and all of these gorgeous, gorgeous greens.
Yeah, so like you said, I live up the street, and I was literally just in the market and I noticed that her stuff was beautiful. And I went up to her and I said, how can I buy from you?
Seems to be the theme. I did the exact same thing. And coming up in the fall, she has all these chicories, which I know she's quite famous for. Do you buy those at the restaurant?
Yes. Her greens, her chicories, everything is gorgeous. And you can tell by the color, the smell, and just how everything is bright. You can tell she treats her soil really well.
One of the things we talked about with Megan was the fact that she sells her greens unwashed. So what are your tips about cleaning lettuce and then caring for it once it gets into the fridge?
Yeah, that's a great question. I actually look for lettuce that is unwashed. As a shopper, as a chef, you should look for food that actually is dirty because that means it's organic and it's alive. So what you do at a home level and on a restaurant is you take your greens and you rip them from the bottom. You shouldn't cut them. You should rip them, which preserves them longer. And then you put them in a bowl or in a sink with water, cool water, and then let them sit till all the dirt comes off, and then put them in a salad spinner. And then put them in any vessel, like a bowl or a bag, and they'll be clean in your fridge for a couple of days. Then you're ready to go.
Okay. I'm curious about how you choose to dress the different types of lettuce. How do you choose whether or not you're going to do a vinaigrette or like more of a creamy dressing?
So it depends on the hardiness of the lettuce. When the lettuce, like chicory, for example, can handle more dressing per se. So it can handle stronger flavors like anchovies or a cream base, or anything that can hold more body. When the lettuce is soft, like a soft lettuce in the summer, you want to go light. So something more like lemon, olive oil, you know, a tomato vinaigrette, something that celebrates the seasons and also preserves the lettuce itself.
Thank you so much. This has been very inspiring.
Oh, no, thank you.
That was Deborah Taylor, chef at Botanica. You can look for their bright blue doors on Silver Lake Boulevard. For The Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
That's it for our show this week. I hope to see you at tomorrow's tortilla tournament. The festivities start at 3 p.m. at La Plaza downtown, and it goes until 7. Bring your family and friends and come prepared to eat and partay. In case you missed any of this week's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, leave us a review if you liked what you heard. My thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Laurel Garcia, Joseph Stone, and Ronnie Nicholson. I'd like to say a special thanks to Joel Stein, who's moving on from KCRW after several wonderful years as our engineer. Thanks for the memories, Joel. All of us at Good Food will miss you. I'm Evan Kleinman, and I'll be back next week with a new episode of Good Food.